At least this ugly economy is getting some Americans to broaden their horizons.
I am an unemployed graphic artist, so I decided to hire on at a Starbucks. While working there, I also started working as a teller for Bank of America, and now I work night times at casinos.
Tomorrow, the government releases its unemployment statistics for the month of November. Michelle, over in Oklahoma, already knows how bad it is out there. We're collecting stories of listeners being forced to add jobs in a contracting economy. It's a slash world. Artist slash mechanic slash dishwasher. When your economy is a slasher movie, call 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 4th. And John, not only are we finding that our listeners are creative, but also our staff. Brad, he was a milkman by day and a DJ by night. You know that?
That's interesting. I mean, all these stories have a certain amount of opportunistic quality, creativity, and also a certain amount of desperation.
Yeah, necessity. And we're still going to continue to talk about underemployment in America. Also, we'll have a report from Pakistan to see how the Mumbai attacks are changing that volatile region. And Korean barbecue is coming to a small town in Georgia. How a new Kia car plant is changing the area's economy and culture. Those stories are coming up first, these headlines.
Car company CEOs are on the Hill today with a long wish list.
We should maintain a viable auto industry, but we should also make sure that any government assistance that's provided is based on realistic assessments of what the auto market is going to be.
Think of him as the Wizard of Oz. The president-elect Barack Obama is in a position to grant every wish of the auto companies, but the big three are trying to show how realistic they can be. Unlike last time, they've got detailed plans on what they'll do with any government money they receive. The UAW chief says he's willing to give up some worker benefits to help the auto industry. But despite all this, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid isn't sure votes will be there in the Senate for a bailout.
And there's a new report from a panel looking at terror and weapons of mass destruction. They think a biological attack is more likely than a nuclear one.
The terrorists are organizationally sophisticated enough to get either the nuclear or bioweapons, but the bioweapon would be even easier for them to get and then to weaponize.
That's former Senator Jim Talin, who co-chaired the group. Their report says a biological terror attack is likely by 2013. Vice President-elect Joe Biden and Homeland Security nominee Janet Napolitano met with the commission to talk about threat reduction. The report also put Pakistan at the center of the war on terror, even before the Mumbai attacks. India believes two Pakistani militants planned the strikes. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met with Pakistan's president today. He said he'll take strong action against any Pakistanis involved.
Oil prices are near a four-year low, $46 a barrel. Analysts think it soon could drop below $40 a barrel. It's down from a high of $147 a barrel this summer. Wall Street poised to open basically flat or slightly lower. And, of course, we're asking for your slash stories like Michelle in Oklahoma. What are you in this underemployed, contracting economy? Worker slash dishwasher slash mom, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We're asking for a loan here, a loan to be repaid. We're not asking for that famous term that everybody uses. This is a loan to help the industry through an economic downturn that the industry had nothing to do with. And as I indicated to you, it's being felt around the world.
That's Ron Gettelfinger, the president of the United Auto Workers Union, yesterday after the union agreed to major concessions in its bid to help the three big automakers survive. Today, the company's CEOs are back on Capitol Hill to lay out their detailed proposals in an effort to get billions from the federal government. We turn now to Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection, who's joining us with a preview. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
So do you think any of these major concessions the unions have made on health care and payments for laid-off workers, will it help?
Well, I'll tell you who it might help with. It might help with Republicans. There seems to be a consensus in Congress that something needs to be done. Of course, the problem is Republicans and Democrats can't agree on how it should be done and where the money should be coming from. And you've got two competing camps politically and ideologically. Of course, everyone wants the auto industry to survive. Democrats don't want to do anything to hurt one of their core constituencies, which is one of the biggest and most powerful still unions in the country, the UAW and all of their associated unions who work in the auto industry. The Republicans would love to see the unions make some major concessions. They've wanted them to do that for decades. In fact, they have already done some. And they want to help, naturally, probably on the side of management on a lot of these issues. So it may help bring around some Republicans, possibly.
Let's talk about the dynamics of this lame duck session. Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, has said he doesn't believe at this time he has the votes to pass some kind of package for the auto industry. Explain that.
Well, remember what happened in the lame duck a couple of weeks ago, if you can cast your mind back. It was basically a waste of time. Legislatively, the members had to come back for leadership elections anyway, but no votes were even taken in the Senate or in the House. And what Reid said before is he doesn't want to take a bunch of votes that wind up failing because that will hurt the process and the markets even more. He may not be out of that same paradigm right now. And these hearings are going to be interesting because, you know, most hearings on a big issue like this are sort of a should we or shouldn't we? Should we find a way to loan or bail out or help the industry? But the interesting thing here is that's not really what we're talking about. Even almost not every Republican, but almost every Republican in Congress says, yes, we must do something to help the industry. And certainly all the Democrats feel that way. So, again, there's no rift about whether something should be done. It's the old question of how. And a lot of the partisan divides from before the election and even from the last lame duck session, they're still here. So the question, I think, to watch in these hearings will be, will the UAW testimony and the Big Three CEO testimony galvanize people enough that there's enough pressure on the parties and the leaders, the Reid and Pelosi and the Boehner and the McConnell mm-hmm. and Shelby, to come together on something and get it done or kick it to January and let Obama worry about it?
So what are the options if there is this sense that something needs to be done? And you described several different camps. So what are their thoughts about what can be done, and particularly in a week of this session that's left?
Right. Well, you're going to hear a couple of terms probably get thrown around today and tomorrow in hearings. One is TARP, and that's a familiar one. That's the $700 billion bailout kitty that was passed, and everybody remembers that. Democrats are firm in their conviction that we should be using that money as a source of loan money for this auto bailout, maybe 25, maybe 35 billion. Republicans say there's already some money, and they might throw out a term called 136. What 136 is a code for a section of a statute. The 136 account is money that was already set aside for the auto industry to use for retooling their plants for fuel-efficient cars and greener cars. They say, well, use that money. It's already there. Of course, Democrats don't want to do that. So you're going to hear those two terms get thrown around. The interesting thing about TARP is even if the Democrats got the White House, got the president to agree to use TARP money, that TARP money is only available if the White House asks for it. The next $350 billion of that money has to be authorized through the White House and through Congress by law before it can be used. So even if there was the White House has a cudgel here. They don't necessarily even have to ask Congress for the money. That's leverage.
Okay, so we're going to be watching for two things. One, what the Congress comes up with, and two, whether or not the Bush White House will agree. Todd Zwillick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection. He was coming to us from Washington, D.C.
Oh, no, for all you know. No, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
You know, if you listen to the Big Three on Capitol Hill, you might think that the auto industry in the United States is headed for extinction, is shrinking in this economy, and is about to go away. Drew Ferguson, mayor of West Point, Georgia, that's not the view from your window, though, is it?
Absolutely not. Good morning.
Good morning. There's a Kia plant actually going up just down the road from you.
That is correct. Hyundai Kia Corporation and Kia Motors Manufacturing Georgia is building the largest OEM plant in North America in the city limits of West Point, Georgia.
Now what's an OEM, Drew? You got to help me out with that.
That is an original equipment manufacturer, and this is an assembly plant, and they are going to build the Kia Sorento, which is a midsize SUV, at that facility.
Now, the factory is going to employ how many people?
The factory itself will initially employ about 2,500 production workers.
And for a city your size, that's huge, right?
That is huge, especially when you take into account that we actually have probably about 5,000 manufacturing jobs coming to West Point when you include the suppliers that are located within our city.
Yeah, describe the fact that, you know, there's kind of an auto renaissance going on in your little region there of, you know, sort of Georgia, Alabama. How many plants are we talking here?
With the suppliers, we are probably up to about 8 or 9 plants. But you also have down in Montgomery, Alabama, Hyundai plant in Tuscaloosa. There's a Mercedes plant. There is a BMW plant in South Carolina. Of course, the Nissan plant in Tennessee. So the old southern textile industry is transforming itself into an automotive region.
That's interesting. Well, Drew, can you get your Dodge truck serviced down there in West Point?
Absolutely, you sure can.
But you're not driving a Dodge, though, right?
Right now, I am driving a Kia Sorento, and that again, that will be the car that that's produced here at our facility.
Now, what is it about Kia Hyundai that's making it possible for them to expand when the American automakers are having such difficulty?
I believe that Kia is committed to building the highest quality cars in the world. And this organization, if you spend some time around them, they are committed to a long-term business plan that utilizes great technology, great engineering. And they are, like I said, I believe that they are committed to being the best manufacturer in the world.
And they see
this market as somewhere that they would like to be.
But there's no union down there in West Point, Georgia, right?
That is correct.
And what does that do to reduce costs for Kia, which is already selling cars for a pretty low price to begin with?
You know, I would have to defer that question. I'm not sure what exactly that does to their cost structure. I know that they looked at our workforce, and they looked at a region that, again, for the better part of a century was in the textile business, and they saw a workforce that that was very dedicated and very very good at what they did. And I feel like that's going to translate well into the automotive industry. And we've been in a 2-decade decline of the textile industry, and so now we have this wonderful opportunity to reinvent ourselves.
Now, Mayor Ferguson, I read a couple of articles that suggested that there isn't a lot of sympathy down in your neck of the woods for the Detroit automakers, and that some people in your neck of the woods actually oppose the bailout because it'll make it harder for you to compete with Detroit.
The general sense of the public here is that they do not support the bailout, not just of the auto industry, but of just about anything. Again, this region saw a textile manufacturing base go overseas for about 2 decades, and we certainly didn't receive any federal help for
that. Right. No, that's a good. You make a good point, Mayor Ferguson. Before we go, you know, what's your favorite fast food?
Well, actually, I try not to eat a whole lot of it now.
You're going to have to learn a little bit about dumplings, aren't you?
Well, we have certainly seen an Asian influence in our community, and it's wonderful. It's really a neat time for us down here.
All right, and your kids will actually eat the hot sauce?
Actually, my oldest son and I went to eat sushi the other day, and surprisingly, he really enjoyed it.
All right, Drew Ferguson, mayor of West Point, Georgia, thanks for joining us, where a Kia plant is going to be opening soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm a gardener slash musician slash radio host. What's your slash?
My name is Kaya Wong. I'm working part-time for a doctor, and I also do Thai massage and make soaps and lip balms for lipsbywong.com, my own company, and play music, and I think many jobs is a good solution right now.
Looking for good solutions is what a lot of people are doing in this economy. What's your solution to this economic downturn? Tell us your slash at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Now we go overseas, because today Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was in Pakistan following her trip to India. She was urging Pakistani officials to fully share any information they have about the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, for which many suspect Pakistani militants. The secretary said she was satisfied with Pakistan's commitment to fight terrorism and its readiness to pursue any lead on the terrorist attacks in India. We talked earlier with the BBC's Pakistan correspondent, Charles Haviland, and I asked him what Rice said she had been told by Pakistani officials.
Well, she did indeed have smoother things to say, if you like, than she was saying about Pakistan in Delhi. In Delhi and on the way from Delhi to reporters on the plane, she was saying that Pakistan must mount a robust effort to hunt people down. What she said at the end of her brief talks here was that she found the leadership to be very focused and very committed. I think that the Pakistani top government leaders, such as President Zardari and the Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, will have said what they have been saying in public, which is that Pakistan has every sympathy with what has happened to the people of Mumbai and the people of India. She said that they had made it clear that they did not want to be associated, as she put it, in any way with terrorist elements, and I think that they will have impressed this upon her. Obviously, we can only speculate what was said in private, and the United States is hinting that it agrees with the Indian accusation against the Kashmiri militant group Lashkar-e-Toiba, which was actually banned in Pakistan 6 or 7 years ago, but whose former leaders, some of whose former leaders are here and are now doing other things quite openly. So she may well have pressed that kind of point home. We can only speculate what the response might have been. But I think Pakistan's line generally these days is that if it has evidence of complicity by people in the Mumbai attacks, then it will take action against them. But without that kind of evidence being produced, it won't do so.
Let's listen to what the secretary said yesterday.
There is urgency to getting to the bottom of it. There is urgency to bringing the perpetrators to justice, and there is urgency to using the information to disrupt and prevent further attacks.
She's talking there about the investigation of the Mumbai attacks. How much pressure do you think the U.S. can put on Pakistan to fully share what information they have and to act if they have actionable information?
Well, I think obviously diplomatic pressure coming from an ally as such as the United States is to Pakistan will possibly be quite considerable. It would be very interesting to know what information has been given. One of the journalists asked Condoleezza Rice at the press conference what evidence has India produced, and Condoleezza Rice said it's not a question of sharing evidence. There's a lot of information around and lots of ways and lots of mechanisms to share it. So I suppose that in itself is a means of pressure, because it's an implication that Pakistan must have its own evidence of complicity by certain Pakistani elements. I have to be careful. We're not saying anything about Pakistani government elements, but possibly Pakistani citizens, etc. But it's obviously not an easy thing for the United States to pressurize Pakistan purely on the basis that it might have evidence of Pakistani citizens' involvement in these attacks. They may be Pakistani citizens over whom the Pakistani state has very little control. Indeed, I'm told by some experts here that Lashkar-e-Toiba, after it was banned in 2002, it really was fairly much dispersed and now has more of a presence within India, even though it started as a Pakistani Kashmir militant group, but it has more of a presence within India, within certain parts of India, including Mumbai, in which case the onus might really be on the Indian authorities to try and do something about it. Pakistan has been pushing this line a fair amount, or at least some commentators here are, that India shouldn't only be lashing out at Pakistan, but should also be looking to itself, trying to perhaps keep its own house in order and ask whether there might be homegrown elements among these militants.
In terms of the Pakistani government, though, it's already been resistant to the idea of handing over suspects that India has indicated they would like to have.
Well, that's right. Yeah, Pakistan's president did say on CNN, in fact, about 36 hours ago, that he doubted that even the surviving gunman, who the Indians insist is Pakistani, President Zardari was saying he doubted that the man is Pakistani. Similarly, when India produced a list of 20 men that it said were in Pakistan and were complicit, Pakistan turned around and said, well, this is an old list which you have produced on numerous occasions in the past. There's nothing new here. And yes, if you can produce evidence, then we will try these men ourselves. But if you can't produce evidence, we can't do anything about this at the moment. And I think other states in the world, if given lists of people to hand over, would probably take a similar line, which is that they're not simply going to just hand them over on a bald request like that.
Charles Haviland is a BBC correspondent in Pakistan, and he was coming to us from Islamabad. And now we're going to get some headlines from Femi Oke, who has just joined us on this Thursday, December 4th.
Thanks for stretching it, Dora. I appreciate that. It is 27 minutes past the hour. Good morning. The CEOs of the big three automakers give it one more try today, and they're back before Congress requesting tens of billions of dollars. And this time they've brought detailed plans on how they use the money and promises to cut their hefty salaries. And that's an improvement from the last visit, but it may not be enough. Senator Majority Leader Harry Reid says that he doesn't think the votes are there. The United Auto Workers Union says that it's willing to make sacrifices to help automakers get the loan package they want. The union is offering to give up certain worker benefits. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice visited Pakistan to encourage leaders there to fight terror by helping India investigate the Mumbai attacks. She met with Pakistan's president, who vows strong action against any Pakistanis involved in the attacks. And India says that two Pakistani militants masterminded the attacks last week. Indian police say that they found a hand grenade outside a Mumbai hospital, and that was on the site of one of last week's attacks in Mumbai. And police say that it may have been left by the gunman. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper says he is fighting for his political life. Three opposition parties signed a pact earlier this week, vowing to oust his minority Conservative Party government. They say he's failed to address the economic crisis, and Harper is working to head off a no-confidence vote set for Monday. He wants to suspend Parliament until next month. The Dalai Lama is in Europe this week, urging the European Union to support human rights for the Chinese. And Tibet's spiritual leader took a moment to reflect on President Bush and his 8 years in office.
I love Mr. Bush. Oh, very straightforward, very nice person as a human being. But some of his policy, I don't know. Some cases, a little disaster.
Didn't mince any words there.
It's a very infectious chuckle, isn't it? That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This week we're looking at underemployment in America, and we've been asking the question, are we becoming a nation of part-timers?
I am a student now slash student from my last education. No work in sight yet, so I'm a student/student.
How about a meat cutter/newspaper carrier or a cab driver/pizza deliverer? We want your story about how you're coping, how you're making ends meet, and perhaps doing it with multiple jobs. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin, now Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, has at least one slash in his name. He's President/Prime Minister. And today on television in Moscow, he officially ruled out an early return to Russia's presidency. It was part of an annual address when Russians get to talk to their leader. And when Russians tune in, of course, it's not President Medvedev that they want to talk to. It's Vladimir Putin, the prime minister, who started this tradition a while back. And we talked earlier with the BBC's Moscow correspondent, James Rogers, as the broadcast in Moscow all over Russia was getting going. And I asked him about the venerableness of this tradition.
This was a tradition which Mr. Putin began became something of an annual event, in fact, when he himself was president. Of course, earlier this year, he stepped over to become prime minister, while, as you rightly point out, his successor, Dmitry Medvedev, took the top job in the Kremlin. Yet, here again this year, it's Mr. Putin and not Mr. Medvedev who's taking the calls from across the world's biggest country.
Well, James, of course, that only means that Dmitry Medvedev is very, very busy around this time of year and can't afford to spend the time doing the broadcast, right? There could be no other explanation for that, right?
Well, Mr. Medvedev's actually away on a state visit to India at the moment, so he's out of the country altogether. But, of course, the way that a lot of people read this is that despite the fact that he's no longer in what is nominally the top job in Russia, it is Vladimir Putin and not Dmitry Medvedev who wields the real political power here.
Right.
And he's been back giving his rather impressive annual talk to the nation, if you like, taking those calls, showing a great deal of detail. But of course, there are big questions over just how many of these questions he might know in advance and how many of them are genuine surprises.
Let's talk about the pain that Putin must be experiencing right now. Has it come up yet, the precipitous drop in oil prices? Because that was really driving Putin's sort of challenging behaviors this summer. That seems to have gone away.
That has come up, I think, particularly, actually, in one questioner, representing a motorists organization, who said, well, look, if the price of oil has gone down by as much as 2/3, why isn't the price of petrol or gasoline, why isn't that going down in the same way? And this was a chance for Mr. Putin to refer to that. I mean, I would say, generally, he's not trying to put a gloss on things. He is saying, yes, unemployment is going to rise. Yes, these things are going to be tough. What he's trying to do, I think, overall, if there's one single message he's trying to get across, is that, yes, things are tough, but we're in charge, we're in control. We're not going to see any of the crises that this country has experienced, first with the ending of communism in the early 1990s, and secondly with a real major financial crisis in the late 1990s.
So, is this a real call-in show, James? Any sense of whether or not it's pre-recorded?
I think there's no question that it is actually live because we've got colleagues who are actually there. It did begin across one of Russia's main TV channels, on two radio stations, and also online at midday Moscow time. That's a little over 2.5 hours ago. Mr. Putin, I should say, is still going strong at this stage. People were able to submit questions beforehand to a website. But there, when they did that, they had to give all kinds of details like their full name and their home address. So there was no possibility of hiding behind any kind of anonymity there. To look at it, the studio discussion is apparently live and spontaneous. But of course, there are questions just over how much these remarks may have been filtered out or edited beforehand.
No Joe the Plumber in this encounter with Vladimir Putin. I'm wondering if Russians, judging by the questions, care at all about the kinds of things that Putin has brought to the international stage, Russia being a power in Europe, pushing back on Ukraine, pushing back on NATO. Do Russians seem to care about that sort of thing?
There have been a few questions along those lines. I would stress that most people seem to be talking about their concerns over the possibility of unemployment, concerns over paying their mortgages, concerns over pensions. Inflation in Russia is running at 13% this year. At least that's what the Prime Minister said it's probably likely to touch. To try to put a bit of a positive gloss on that, he said that wages are up 12.6%, but nevertheless, you don't have to be a mathematical genius to work out that things don't look great. As far as international questions go, there's a looming, well, at least there's an ongoing gas row between Russia and Ukraine. You may recall just a few years ago that Russia and Ukraine didn't manage to resolve a dispute over pricing, with the result that some gas supplies to Western Europe were cut, some of those supplies which transit through Ukraine. There's a question about that. How can we solve our differences with Ukraine? Also references to Russia's military conflict with Georgia in the summer, and also references to the United States, with Mr. Putin expressing the hope that given the incoming new administration in the United States, that there may be an improvement in relations between Russia and the United States. Those, of course, have been pretty scratchy at times over the last couple of years, to say the least.
James, in conclusion, is there any sense from the questions of Russian people there on the program, and you've already referred to the inflation number, that the economic downturn is taking hold inside Russia as well as other places around the world?
I don't think there's any question about that, because, as you pointed out, one of the things that's really been driving the Russian economy pretty much for all the time that Mr. Putin was president, from 2000 to 2008, was those rising oil prices. That's been bringing billions of dollars into the Russian economy, and that's been going out into service industries. It's been going out. And everybody, nearly everybody at least, or many, many Russians have definitely been benefiting from that. And some people are beginning to feel the cold wind now. Hmm. People talking about how they've lost their jobs, how they're going to feel their family. So if, I think, earlier this year Russia sensed and at least publicly claimed that it was going to be somehow protected from the global financial crisis, I think that's a reality. Reality has proved something very different.
James Rogers is the Moscow correspondent with our partner, the BBC, there in Moscow. And we have headlines from Femi Oke now.
Thank you very much. The time just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Just been getting the unemployment numbers out for this hour. The report says that the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week dropped to 509,000. The continuing claims hit a 26-year high. The US needs to boost its vigilance against nuclear and biological attacks. That's according to a new report out from a bipartisan commission on terrorism led by former Senators Jim Talent and Bob Graham. Walmart says that it's working with law enforcement to beef up safety measures. The retailer is under fire after an employee died on Black Friday. Customers trampled the man after he opened the door for a holiday sale. And the family is planning lawsuits against the store and local authorities. The U.S. is returning stolen artifacts to Egypt. Federal immigration officials returned more than 80 ancient items yesterday, and they've been taken from a museum 6 years ago by an army helicopter pilot and later sold to an antiquities dealer. American customs officials recovered them back in 2006. That's a quick look at your headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and we're used to seeing doctors with pagers, and of course that means they probably have cell phones as well. But recently, Dr. David Knott, who's a vascular surgeon for Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, received this text message on his cell phone. Start on clavicle, remove middle third, control and divide the subclavian artery and vein, divide large trunks around these approximately as possible, P-O-S-S, period. Possible was abbreviated. Now, Dr. David Knott, you knew what to do when you got that text message, right?
Well, I work with Professor Thomas, who's at the Professor of Surgery at the Royal Marsden Hospital. And basically, he was the one that has certainly the United Kingdom's experience in doing four-quarter amputations. This operation is very rarely performed in the United Kingdom, probably only about 10, I think, a year, of which Professor Thomas does about 5 to 6 of them.
So you had Professor Thomas on the line, the best guy in the world for this operation. The little detail was that you were in Congo. right?
That's right. I was working in Rutshuru, which was a town, and the MSF had a hospital in Rutshuru, which looked after all the displaced people of the Congo in that area. Plus, we were receiving lots of war injuries and so on from the fighting going on at that time.
And the patient you were dealing with was a little boy who needed a shoulder amputation, a very difficult, delicate operation, which you could only do being coached by text message from London to Congo.
That's correct. Basically, I'd never done this operation before, and it's a very difficult operation. As I said, it's very, very rarely performed in the United Kingdom. And it involved taking the whole of the shoulder off, involving the collarbone, all the muscles and bones around the shoulder, plus the scapula. And it's a very big operation, which carries a significant mortality in the best of hands. But here we had a little boy who was only 16, who's had his arm ripped off. And the surgeon before me had tried to do an amputation, but unfortunately there's only about 6 inches of arm left, and this was very infected, and the muscles were infected, the bone was infected, and the boy was becoming septicemic, and he probably had about 4 or 5 days to live.
Dr. Knott, I hate to interrupt you because I'm absolutely riveted, but did you text back to the doctor while you were doing the operation?
No, what happened was that I knew we had to do a four-quarter amputation, so I texted Professor Thomas and said, can you take me through this by text messages? And he texted me back and said, yes, I'll give you all the steps for it. So basically, he gave me about 10 steps to follow to do this operation.
Wow. And how's the little boy doing?
Well, I was amazed, really, because the operation, he had about an 80% mortality risk for the operation, but he got through it, and we only had 1 pint of blood in this little hospital
that we were working.
And we had no intensive care, no nothing. And basically, I looked after him personally, and I spent a couple of weeks there at Rutshuru before I had to leave. He pulled through.
That's fantastic. Dr. Knott, you know, a lot of times when people send text messages, you know, if they get emotional, they send things like, you know, LOL, laugh out loud, or maybe they send a smiley at the end. Did you get a smiley at the end of this?
No, he just Professor Thomas, with tongue in cheek, gave me two very long text messages, and at the end of it wrote, easy, good luck, Myrian. And so wow. I think the easy was, it could be translated as being extremely difficult, good luck.
Well, if anybody deserved a smiley on their text message, it would be you. Dr. David Knott, thanks so much for joining us.
Our pleasure, thank you.
Dr. David Knott, a vascular surgeon, a volunteer for Doctors Without Borders, who performed a shoulder amputation by text. In Congo.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 4th. Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. Condoleezza Rice is in Pakistan today, talking to military and civilian leaders. Secretary Rice says that the Pakistani leadership has told her that it is committed to helping India investigate last week's militant attacks in the city of Mumbai. The president of Pakistan said his government would take strong action against any Pakistani elements found to be involved in the terror attacks. Two suicide car bombings near police stations in Fallujah, Iraq, have killed a reportedly 15 people and wounded more than 100 others. One station was said to be leveled, that's a police station, and it's believed the bombings were coordinated because they were only a few minutes apart. Iraq's government says that it got a telephone call from President-elect Barack Obama. Prime Minister's office says that Obama thanked the government for helping win approval of a new security pact and stressed his commitment to a responsible troop withdrawal. Now, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq had no problems taking the president-elect's phone call. But when he called a Florida congresswoman this week, she was so determined not to be punked that she hung up on Barack Obama. Right. Now, this is according to the Miami Herald, and her name was Elena Ralustinen, and she got the call yesterday from a man who sounded remarkably like Barack Obama, funny that, and he wanted to congratulate her on her re-election and said that he was looking forward to working with her. And the Congresswoman said that the caller sounded better than that guy on Saturday Night Live, but she wasn't going to be punked. So she put the phone down. Obama's chief of staff called. She put the phone down on him. And it wasn't until a fellow congressman who was happened to be a Republican called her that she actually believed that it was a legitimate call. And the president-elect laughed it off. And finally, last night, the Grammy nominations were televised live. Louisiana rapper Lil Wayne has the most nominations at 8. Coldplay, a close second at 7. Kanye West trailing with a 6 number of nominations. And B.B. King is probably one of the oldest nominees at 83 years old. And the blues legend says he's an old hand at being nominated for the Grammys.
I think it's happened about 13 times before, and it's still more so, I guess. The older I get and still people remember me, I'm happy.
B.B. King's album One Kind Favor is nominated in the traditional blues category. The 51st Grammys will be next February the 9th. That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi.
So we are a nation of part-timers, and we're looking at your slash stories. Sydney Patton emailed us on our website. My creative solution to the financial challenges in the midst of all this economic turmoil has been to produce a one-person play for high school students on depression awareness and suicide prevention. Levels of depression are high these days, so not surprisingly, my play is really starting to do quite well. I feel like I'm helping people out. A teacher slash playwright, what's your solution? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This week we've been looking at underemployment, that is, of course, American workers that want full-time work but end up working part-time jobs just to get by. It's the demographics of underemployment that we're dealing with this morning, and who's bearing the brunt of the current job market? For that, we turn to Jeffrey Wenger, an assistant professor of public policy analysis at the University of Georgia. Good morning and welcome, Professor.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So give us the lay of the land. Who's most vulnerable and who's getting hit first in this turbulent economy?
Well, I just have to say, first off, is I'm struck by the size and the rapidity of how fast this situation has grown. The number of people who want full-time work, who can only find part-time work, is just skyrocketed in the last year. It's predominantly women, African Americans, teenagers, Latinos, numbers of vulnerable groups that have typically had less than stellar employment experiences.
When we take a look at the numbers, they're all overwhelming. So let's just take a look at November. The U.S. economy shed 250,000 private sector jobs. Why are those particular groups that you just listed, why are they particularly vulnerable?
Well, a lot of the time they work in industries and in occupations that are really sensitive to changes in the business climate. So if you work in retail sales, and retail sales haven't been as strong as we might like, then there's jobs are easily shed, and they tend to be part-time workers that are let go. So it has a lot to do with what industry you work in.
Does it have much to do with what region of the country you live in?
It tends to ultimately hit all regions of the country. So it might start on the coasts and then migrate into the heartlands, but eventually it's tough to be insulated geographically.
And you have some personal experience with this because your dad actually is among one of those vulnerable groups, and he's unemployed.
He is. He was a shoe salesman and recently lost his job 6 months ago and hasn't been able to find a similar job since then.
So what are you seeing? How are people responding? As you noted at the beginning, you said you've never seen the numbers so quickly rise of those who are being thrown into this part-time world. What are the trends you are seeing as people try to cope?
It's very difficult from the official statistics to see how people are going to cope. So you can look at multiple, you know, people with multiple jobs, but as the economy continues to contract and there are fewer and fewer jobs, it makes that strategy more difficult to achieve. How do you hold more than one part-time job when there are fewer and fewer jobs being made?
I mean, people are carrying these slash careers around with them, and we've been getting these amazing stories of people trying to bounce from job to job and experiencing exactly what you're suggesting, that as soon as they get another part-time job, it goes away because they're sort of following the contraction through the economy as they try to take on work. And now, looking at the demographics of this, even with the rapid onset that you're seeing, Is there a way for policymakers to target training programs and some sort of a cushion, be it unemployment insurance, be it some sort of medical care tied over that might help these various vulnerable groups?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is one of the things that's sort of very sad about the current situation is that these part-time workers and workers who want more, better and more hours than they can get, they're really the shock absorbers of the economy right now. They're the ones who are sort of taking the brunt of it, and our safety net, the unemployment insurance benefits that we offer, some states don't offer benefits to those workers, and they'll pay taxes, they'll pay for the benefit for both jobs. So you'll have two part-time jobs, you'll pay your unemployment insurance taxes in both of the jobs, and be left ineligible for benefits in either job.
And that's because state regulations stipulate they're ineligible as part-timers?
Yes. If they search exclusively for part-time work in many states, they're ineligible to receive benefits.
Well, you know, I imagine people out of work are looking to relocate. Are there states where it's actually a progressive good policy?
Yes. I mean, there's a number of them, and they would be all the usual suspects. You could go to California or New York, and you would be eligible to receive benefits as a part-time worker.
Are there some industries, in addition to the policies of the state, are there some particular industries that are more welcoming to part-time workers?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, if you look out there, you'll find that half of all part-time workers are concentrated in a small group of industries, like retail sales, hospitals, nursing. The grocery stores in particular are very, very large employers of part-time workers.
And so what's your advice based on the knowledge you've accumulated to those who are trying to find their way? What have you been saying to your dad?
Well, it's very, very difficult. It's very challenging. It's hard not to get frustrated. You know, obviously my father's an older worker who he's nearly ready for retirement. He's 64. He would like to continue to work, but it's very difficult to find a new job. And I can only tell him that he just has to keep plugging away at it, and hopefully something will come through for him. He doesn't get to choose to work. He has to only chooses to search, and he has to find someone willing to hire him. And that's very difficult.
Jeffrey Wenger, thank you for joining us this morning.
It was my pleasure.
Jeffrey Wenger is the assistant professor of policy analysis at the University of Georgia. He was talking to us about the growing number of the underemployed.
Well, Jeffrey's dad does not get to choose. Many of you do not get to choose your job. Your slashes are compulsory in this crazy economy. What's yours?
I'm a full-time meat cutter in the Boston area. Instead of getting a second job as a meat cutter at night, I decided to get up a few hours earlier in the morning and I deliver the newspaper. I made almost $100,000 last year. That way I can pay my job support. And so I'm doing quite well. Food and newspapers seem to be pretty steady, and the economy hasn't really affected me.
So what's your slash at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org? That seems like a pretty good strategy. What's yours? We're always on here at The Takeaway, and you can follow our entire underemployment series at our website. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go, and you can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
And here's your takeaway.
The White House has a cudgel here. They don't necessarily even have to ask Congress for the money.
A cudgel. That's Todd Zwillick with Capital News Connection talking about the auto industry heads on Capitol Hill asking for billions.
They may be acquiring some slashes if it doesn't work out on Capitol Hill. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Those Saturn car owners. Now, there's an unusual bunch.
You will attend a Saturn picnic, and you will enjoy yourself. And then you will take a 6-day tour of the Saturn factory and reprogramming center.
Honey, I'm scared.
Oh, different kind of company. A different kind of car.
Oh, wow. Saturn owners were just too cool for school there for a while. Now the GM brand may go away entirely, cannibalizing the big innovative idea to save the company. Are Saturn owners going to need deprogramming? Well, you've come to the right place. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 4th, and it certainly has been a long, strange ride for the Saturn, which started off with so much promise and hasn't done well, and now, well, it might go away.
Yeah, it's a really big planet. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to have a report on what's happening with Saturn. We're going to cover the auto industry's woes in general, and we're going to take a look at a new report, new data about a possible terror attack, sometime biological attack, sometime in the next several years. Those stories coming up. But first, these headlines.
Economic troubles top our news. Just last hour, AT&T rolled out plans to cut 12,000 jobs. That's a full 4% of its workforce. The cuts start this month. Fresh unemployment numbers just out last hour. New unemployment claims dropped a bit. That's a nice surprise. But unfortunately, the number of people staying on unemployment hit a 26-year high. Tomorrow is the big number, the unemployment rate for November.
The United Auto Workers would prefer its members don't join the unemployment line, so union chief Ron Gettelfinger supports the Big Three CEO's request for tens of billions in taxpayer money, but don't call it a bailout.
We're asking for a loan here, a loan to be repaid. We're not asking for that famous term that everybody uses. This is a loan to help the industry through an economic downturn that the industry had nothing to do with.
The UAW is offering worker benefit cuts to support the automakers' requests on Capitol Hill. We'll talk to a Chrysler worker in a moment, see what he thinks about all of this. Gettelfinger and the chiefs of the Big Three automakers testify in the Senate later today. Hearings start in under an hour. This time, the CEOs have detailed plans, promises to cut their pay, and even a dash of contrition, but it's far from clear they'll have the votes to get what they want.
An alarming prediction yesterday from a leading terror research panel.
It is more likely than not that a weapon of mass destruction will be used someplace in the world prior to the end of the year 2013.
That's former Senator Bob Graham, who's going to join us shortly on the program and talk about the implications of that report, the proliferation of WMD in the next few years. We're going to have more on that in just a moment. We are becoming a nation of part-timers. You've been hearing that all week. Tell us your slash.
I am a librarian / bluegrass honky-tonk musician, and have been for many years.
You've been hearing all week long. We've been asking for your / careers. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. It's a serious attempt to get inside the narrative of this contracting economy. How are you making ends meet with part-time jobs? More than 6 million Americans are in the part-time underemployed workforce. That's our series this week.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The word concessions, I used to cringe at that word, but now, why hide from it? That's what we did.
You can hear it all there in the voice of United Auto Workers President Ron Gettelfinger. He spoke following a meeting with union leadership on the 3rd of December, and he was speaking on CNN about discussions within the UAW to assist the automakers in coming up with a plan that Congress can support to allow the automakers to get as much as $35 billion in, call it bailout, call it bridge loans, call it some sort of restructuring, re-strategizing money that's going to keep the Big Three automakers afloat. But really, we wanted to focus this morning on the cycle psychological sea change that's really taken place on the shop floor in the factories throughout the Detroit automakers, really throughout the country. And joining us from Warren, Michigan is Ken Mefford, who's a Chrysler worker, a quality control worker for Chrysler. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You know, I grew up in Michigan, Ken, and I can remember doing summers at the factories, some of the various factories. There was a Fisher Body factory where I went to school, and there was a sense of confrontation, really, among the union guys versus the management. And it seems from listening to Gettelfinger, and, you know, that was a long time ago, that has really, really changed. And the UAW, once known for being out front as a real tough negotiator, is now suddenly out front as a collaborator with management to save your jobs.
Oh, yeah.
What's that like on the shop floor? You must have been having conversations you never imagined you would have on the shop floor.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm a third-generation auto worker. I mean, my grandfather worked at, and I have his retirement watch, signed Henry Ford II. I mean, I can remember going to, like, River Rouge. I'm 46 as a little kid. And this is back when we were making, this is like 72, 73, back when we were like making like the last of the big Mustangs.
River Rouge is the big, giant Ford plant there outside of Detroit that also produced its own steel.
Right. Basically, it was Henry Ford's idea of, I control everything going in, so I can control everything going out. I have raw steel, raw rubber, you know, it's on the river, so I have my own power. I have everything there coming in as raw materials going in, and I have a brand new Mustang or whatever coming out.
And all that's gone.
Oh, yeah. That's all history. I mean, now it's where you used to have, like, once I work at Dodge Truck, and like one section where I used to work, you had, it was like 9 or 10 people assembling bumpers and putting it on the vehicle. Now all that is coming pre-assembled. And we used to have 10, 12 people. Now you got, I think, 3.
So the number of workers has come down, and the sort of
automation is now the name of the game is, you know, get it there. I mean, still do a quality job, but get there as cheap as you can with as few people as you can.
What do you tell your kids about the future of this industry as you try to explain to young people what the implications of this bailout and the concessions that you're offering are?
Like I said, I'm not trying to correct anybody, but this isn't so. I mean, I'm not Citicorp where I came to you and said, "Hey, God forbid somebody wake up and they say my house lender went out of business, so I get my house for free." Okay, this isn't Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG, Citicorp, which, by the way, some of them already been back into the government for a second time around for basically free money. This is, hey, they're not lending, the banks aren't lending money anymore. I live in Warren, and Michigan's like right up there within the top 5 highest tax places, right up with California.
So I used the word bailout deliberately, Ken, and I see it got a response. You're definitely pushing me back there.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, a bailout to me is basically you're giving me free money. And this is, I mean, think of Chrysler back in 79, because my dad retired from Mound Road Engine. It used to be an engine plant and is now an open field. I mean, think back then. I mean, when the government helped Chrysler survive, the government made money. Everybody, I mean, the government gave them $1.5 billion back in 79, was given, I believe, 10 years to repay the loan.
And they did.
And they did, but they did in, I think, 3 or 4 years.
Ken.
And they made money off it.
Sure they did. Sure they did.
Something similar with this is going to be.
Sure. All right, Ken, do you think this is going to work out? Do you think they're going to make it? We got to go here, but what do you think, yes or no?
I'd say yes, but it's going to take give and take on all sides.
All right, Ken. Well, we're hearing the anguish and the anticipation in your voice there. Ken Mefford is a quality control worker for Chrysler. He spoke to us 3 generations in the auto industry from Warren, Michigan. Thank you, Ken.
And the top executives of the 3 big automakers will be on Capitol Hill today talking about the detailed cuts they plan to make in order to make their business viable. And that could spell the end of Saturn.
Last summer, we invited everyone who owns a Saturn to visit Spring Hill, a Saturn homecoming. They could see where their cars were built and meet the people who built them. We could thank them for believing.
Saturn was launched in 1990, and it was introduced as a different kind of company. It wasn't just a car. It was a club, an experience. But that allure didn't last. And as the auto industry flounders today, GM says it will explore alternatives for Saturn. For more, we're joined by Micheline Maynard, Detroit-based business correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome back, Mickey.
Morning.
So what happened? We know that Saturn hasn't done that well since 1990, but why is it now on the chopping block?
It's very sad in a way what happened with Saturn, because General Motors really had a hit on its hands at the beginning. Actually, when I was looking at sales numbers for my story yesterday, it turns out that sales at Saturn peaked in 1994. So it's had kind of a bumpy road. General Motors started it as a small car company and then didn't give it any more product. So it stayed a small car company while SUVs were selling. And it almost killed it once before and then decided, well, this is someplace we can put our European models. And that hasn't really worked. And so this year, Saturn may sell fewer than 200,000 cars for the first time since 1992. And I think General Motors is just looking at everything across the company. Under 200,000 units isn't enough to sustain a division anymore. And that's why Saturn is possibly on the chopping block.
But what went wrong with the idea? And is Saturn a symbol of just how wrong the car company's strategy has been the last two decades?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think what went wrong with Saturn was that there were some terrific ideas behind it. I mean, what car buyer wouldn't want to be treated, you know, like a human being with respect?
Right.
And what auto worker wouldn't want to be asked for their opinions and their input on making a vehicle work? But, you know, General Motors has a way of taking these innovations and then just forgetting them. And I think what happened with Saturn was something like that. It was an idea by one executive, but when he retired, the other executives who succeeded him had other things on their priority list. And meanwhile, it was so different from the rest of the UAW that the UAW leadership didn't want to support something so radical. And essentially, it was just left almost as an orphan.
So let's talk about today. When GM says it will explore alternatives for Saturn, I mean, what would those alternatives be?
Well, some of the things that they might do is have Saturn dealers combine their Saturn dealerships with their other showrooms, which is not what Saturn was supposed to be. They might look at trying to sell Saturn, the brand, as an entity to, say, a Chinese car maker or someone who would like to pick it up. And they may just quietly let it die. They might just stop giving it new vehicles and let it sort of die a natural death.
And, Mickey, you've been covering the auto industry for some time. What do you make of the chances of the big three on Capitol Hill in the next week?
It's going to depend very much on how they perform in hearings today and tomorrow in Washington, because when they came 2 weeks ago, I think it's roundly agreed that they flopped. They weren't prepared to tell Congress what they were going to do with the money. They came in their private jets, and while I think that was a little bit of a cheap shot, I think that they weren't expecting it and didn't have an answer for it. So they've got to perform in a sterling fashion. Congress has to look over the plans they've submitted and say this is enough. And then we have to get Congress back next week to actually vote on a bailout. And I think if we were doing this in July, it would have a lot better chance. But you're asking members of Congress to come in for one last week for right before Christmas. And that in and of itself might hurt the chances for a bailout.
So it's tough, tough, tough. Micheline Maynard, as always, a great pleasure to have you on our show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Micheline Maynard is a Detroit-based business correspondent with The New York Times covering the auto industry. So
Saturn,
as she points out,
away.
Many layers of complications.
At least we still have the planet Saturn. That's not going away. We can't get rid of that. New way. New sir.
You are just too much, John Hockenberry. Too much.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
To Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. All week we're looking at the changing labor force, and it isn't necessarily changes that people look forward to, but tell us about how you're coping. Tell us your slash story.
I have three jobs. My first job is I work at Radio Shack during the day. Then in the evenings, I work at Sally's Beauty Supply. And then 2 days a week, I teach dance in order to make it.
We want to hear your story about becoming a part-timer. Are we becoming a nation of part-timers? That's what we're looking to hear stories about. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And according to a report released yesterday, it's more likely than not that a weapon of mass destruction will be used somewhere in the world in the next 5 years. That's the takeaway, and it's disturbing. From a report released by the commission created by Congress to study the proliferation of WMDs, and former Senator Bob Graham, excuse me.
Florida, former.
We knew that would happen. Former Senator Bob Graham joins us to talk about the findings of the report. Well, I'm done.
Yeah, I think so, John. A little water's in order. Anyhow, we talked to former Florida Senator Bob Graham. He's talking about findings of the report that he was the chairman for. Senator, we spoke to him a little bit earlier, and we thanked him for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You know, this report is both sobering and absolutely a crucial sort of issue for the transition of Barack Obama to be dealing with. What, first of all, is the headline here? You talked a lot about this 2013 time frame where you expect some weapon of mass destruction is going to be used. Give us some more details on this scenario.
Well, our specific conclusions were that our margin of safety has been declining, that we are more vulnerable today than we were 5 or 10 years ago. Second, that it is more likely than not that between now and the year 2013, a weapon of mass destruction, particularly nuclear or biological, will be used someplace in the world, and that the area of the greatest increasing risk is a biological weapon.
So the good news, perhaps, is that terrorists have realized how difficult it is to use a nuke, but the intent is there to try to get something going on the biological front. What is the technology that is most disturbing to you and the commission?
Well, they have not abandoned their nuclear aspirations. Osama bin Laden, in the early 1990s, first tried to buy fissile material, and that turned out to be a scam. But he's continued his efforts since that time, including relationships with some of the scientists in Pakistan who'd been involved in the proliferation network of the 80s and 90s. But we're most concerned today about the developments in the biological area. Unlike nuclear, which is a man-made material and reasonably scientifically difficult, biological pathogens occur in nature. For instance, anthrax, which is the most likely form of biological attack, is a product from decaying animals. The number of scientists who are capable of taking these materials and develop them into lethal pathogens has multiplied rapidly in the past decade.
Well, Senator Graham, the availability of biological weapons is one danger, but your colleague, Republican Senator Jim Talent, described an even a different advantage of biological weapons. Listen to this for a moment.
If they get a nuclear weapon, it's likely they'd only get one, at least initially, because you have to come up with the nuclear material to do it. But if they isolate a pathogen and are able to weaponize it, there's no reason they wouldn't be able to make more than one weapon and attack more than once.
That's interesting. So the availability is easier for biological weapons, and then once you get them, the multiplication of the weapons is almost trivial.
And there are other advantages to biological. They, for instance, we now have set up radiological sensors in a number of places around the world, borders between countries, seaports, and so the possibility of detecting a nuclear device that is being shipped is at least potentially there, whereas with biological, they don't send off a signature that is identifiable. They also are less dangerous to maintain while you are selecting which target to use them for. So there are a lot of things that would draw a terrorist to a biological as opposed to nuclear weapon.
Senator, even given those threats, I'm surprised to hear you say that we're more vulnerable today, given all of the changes, the security changes and the efforts that have been made since 9/11 to make us more safe.
The problem is like a runner. If you're running fast and you're opponent is standing still, you will be either closing the gap or expanding your own lead.
Mm-hmm.
But if the other runner is running faster than you are, you may be putting in full effort and still falling further and further behind. And in some respects, that's what's been happening in the weapons of mass destruction world. Our opponents have been moving rapidly. As an example, Al-Qaeda on September the 11th, 2001, was a very hierarchical organization with bin Laden making almost all of the important decisions. Today, Al-Qaeda is a flat, horizontal, almost like a franchise organization.
Senator Rob Graham, we're going to take a break there. He's the chair of the Commission on the Prevention of WMD Proliferation and Terrorism. We spoke with him earlier this morning, back when I was actually breathing. And we're going to come back to Senator Graham and talk to him in just a moment. But first, headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. Now, it's just over 500 miles from Detroit to Washington, D.C., and if you drive all of those miles in a Chevrolet hybrid like GM CEO Rick Wagoner did, you only spend about $30 in gas, and that's good for Wagoner, since he and the other big three execs are going to ask Congress for a whole lot more money. The automakers are on the Hill today seeking a multi-billion dollar bailout package. Senate hearings start in the next hour. Oil prices have been very close to a four-year low today. Oil dropped below $46 a barrel. Oil prices have fallen nearly 70% since their peak in July. And some analysts think that it could drop below $40 a barrel this year. A car powered entirely by solar energy has travelled around the world for the first time ever. The small two-seater ended its journey today at the UN climate talks in Poland. And a car can travel up to 55 miles an hour, so the journey took about 17 months and took the driver, who's a Swiss school teacher, through 38 countries. And Walmart says that it's working with law enforcement to beef up safety measures. The retailer is under fire after an employee died on Black Friday. Customers trampled the man after he opened the door for a holiday sale. The family is now planning lawsuits against the store and local authorities. That's a look at some stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Continuing now our conversation with the chair of the Commission on the Prevention of the WMD Proliferation and Terrorism, that's former Senator Bob Graham. Senator, you mentioned the decentralization of Al-Qaeda that has been a principal change since September 11th. And one of the interesting things in your report is that if terrorists like Al-Qaeda make a mistake with bioweapons, it's actually easy to detect that they're using anthrax or other pathogens. But what other countermeasures are out there to improve the monitoring of what's going on with terrorists and WMDs?
We make a series of suggestions domestically and internationally. Here at home, there are currently three or more agencies that have responsibility for regulating high containment laboratories. These are the laboratories in which the most virulent pathogens would be developed and manipulated. We're suggesting that there should be one agency with a single well-enforced standards over the people who work in those labs and the security of the labs themselves. It's ironic that the most recent major attempt to use biological for a weapon in the United States came from a military laboratory, and the suspect, who is now deceased, was a very experienced, long-time employee. That sends a chilling lesson as to how well our most secure labs are being secured. Second, internationally, we have a bioweapons convention, which is now almost 40 years old. We describe it in our report as being anemic. Many countries that are significant biological producers aren't members. They're very limited capability to enforce the standards. We think that a high priority of the next administration internationally needs to be a major rewrite or almost start from scratch in terms of building an international structure to protect against the illicit use of biological materials.
Senator, one question that I hear often when reports like this have been released over the last 7 years or so is, what do you do with that information? And it sort of reminded me a bit of that when I heard Representative Jane Harman's response, which is, it's time to retire the fear card. What should we as Americans do with this information that you're providing?
Well, we're not trying to play the fear card. Our assignment was to assess our current policies and then make recommendations where we felt they needed to be altered in order to enhance the protection of the American people. Part of that assessment is, what is the level of the risk? We talked to over 250 academics, intelligence, military, political people in the United States and abroad, and this was our consensus conclusion as to the three key issues. One, that the threat is growing. Two, that the threat is a five-year, more likely than not. And three, that biologicals are the more likely.
Well, let's take a look at there was also some reference to Pakistan in your news conference yesterday. And, of course, we've seen the terror attacks in Mumbai over the Thanksgiving weekend. You know, small operation, very well-trained individuals, but using very available weapons. Do you see any sort of lessons in the Mumbai attacks as you look back at your report?
Yes, I think the sophistication of the Mumbai attacks, the fact that 10 people using very conventional weapons, automatic weapons and hand grenades, could kill 170-plus people is illustrative of the advances that our adversaries have made in recent years. If those people had used aerosol cans to distribute anthrax or smallpox or some other available pathogen, or if they'd had access to a nuclear weapon, instead of 170 people, it would have been 10 times, 100 times, maybe even 1,000 times that in terms of the number of people killed.
Senator, what is your thought on how prepared Homeland Security is, the department is, to deal with this threat, or is there some overhaul necessary that would make it more effective in confronting these threats?
One of the principal overhauls that we feel are necessary for the Department of Homeland Security is, particularly as it relates to biological, it's been alleged to have taken the attitude of it's too hard to do as it relates to efforts to prevent biologicals, and therefore almost all of the department's efforts have come at the back end. What do you do after the biological attack? We don't accept that. We think there are significant things, many of which the Department of Homeland Security should be the instigator and the leader in accomplishing. At a meeting that we had yesterday with Vice President-elect Biden, also Governor Napolitano, who will be the next Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, was there. She was very focused on this issue, asked a number of probing questions as to what she should have at the top of her priority list when she becomes the secretary.
It sounds like at the very least getting prevention as part of the agenda in the existing Homeland Security administration is probably at the very least a good way to go in the early going. Senator Bob Graham, thanks so much for being a part of the program.
Thank you very much.
We spoke with Senator Bob Graham there. He's the chair of the Commission on the Prevention of WMD Proliferation and Terrorism. The commission released the report yesterday saying a weapon of mass destruction is likely to be used by 2013. Now, more headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Trading has begun on Wall Street just a few moments ago. The S&P down 10 points and the Dow currently down around about 90. The security agreement between the U.S. and Iraq has cleared another hurdle. It's been approved by Iraq's Presidential Council, which means it can take effect in January, but it must still face Iraqi voters in a referendum next year. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice visited Pakistan to encourage leaders there to fight terror by helping India investigate the Mumbai attacks. She met with Pakistan's president, who vows strong action against any Pakistanis involved in the attacks. India says that two Pakistani militants masterminded the terrorism. Indian police say that they found a hand grenade outside a Mumbai hospital. That was the site of one of last week's attacks. Police say that it may have been left by the gunman. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper says he's fighting for his political life. Three opposition parties signed a pact earlier this week, vowing to oust his minority Conservative Party government. They say he's failed to address the economic crisis. Harper's working to head off a no-confidence vote set for Monday. No Canadian government has ever been removed by such a vote and without an intervening election. And finally, the nominations have been announced for the Grammys, and topping the list of most nominated is Lil Wayne.
I heard you were looking for me.
Hello. That's Mr. Carter from Lil Wayne's album. The Carter 3, one of the nominees for Album of the Year. I'm having trouble not saying the double T's there. Lil Wayne has eight Grammy nominations. I feel like I've lost my two front teeth. Grammys next February the 9th.
Thanks, Mammy.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And markets are responding to the apparent story that banks in Europe and in London have put inflation aside and are finally focused on dealing with the economic downturn. Interest rate drops by the Bank of England, 1 percentage point drop. The European Central Bank just cut interest rates 75 basis points. They now stand at 2.5%. Joining us to talk about the implications of this, Andrew Walker, BBC economics correspondent, joins us from London. Andrew, the markets aren't reacting positively to this, and I suspect part of the reason is that this was viewed as a late move.
There's maybe an element of truth in that, although I have to say before the interest rate cuts were announced, markets were already somewhat up in anticipation. I think the subsequent decline actually is more to do with the welcome for a signal that central banks have now pretty much definitively put aside their concerns about inflation and are focusing on the economic downturn. I think that was very much outweighed by the rather depressing news from the United States retail sector, and that has made, I think, a lot of investors in Europe focus once again on the likelihood that we are looking at the prospect of a fairly nasty recession.
Well, let's compare the nasty recession to these delicious-looking interest rates. I mean, the mortgage rate in the United States hit about 4.5% yesterday as a result of moves that the Treasury made. Is there any indication that banks are starting to lend and that credit loosening and liquidity is coming back to the markets in Europe and the economies of England?
There's been some moderately encouraging signs. One of the things that a lot of people in financial markets look at is interest rates charged in what's called the interbank market. And those certainly have come down significantly in the last couple of months, basically starting off with the big banking rescues bailouts that we had a few weeks back. And it's also the case that following the latest interest rate cut from the Bank of England, one percentage point, at least one big British bank has said that it's going to, that the Royal Bank of Scotland has said that it's going to pass on the full reduction to its borrowers. I have to
but
say...
But that's a slow trickle down. I mean, you talked about the retail sector a moment ago.
Yeah.
I mean, banks lending to banks isn't going to get consumers charging stuff at Macy's.
Sure. Well, there is another sometimes unspoken agenda going on here, I think, which is that actually there's a good case for saying that banks really shouldn't be passing on the full reduction to their customers, because one of the things that cuts in official interest rates do is allow banks to increase the margin that they can earn on their lending, which means they can make slightly better profits and start to repair all the financial damage that they've sustained over those losses they've made on bad loans. Now, you know, politically, nobody wants to say that. It's very much the agenda for politicians is that banks should be passing on the full cut to their customers. But actually, there's a good case for saying, well, maybe not quite all of it should be going on.
Well, the trade-off, and we've been dealing with this puzzle all throughout this downturn, is it better to have people save? Is it better to have people spend? Is it better to have people borrow? Is it better for banks to be profitable? I guess we're not really going to know the answer to that question until this whole thing is over, and we're looking at 2010 for that at the very least, Andrew Walker. Thanks so much for joining us. Andrew Walker is BBC Economics correspondent, talking about the interest rates dropping in Europe and the UK, and he spoke with us from London.
Nothing simple about this.
Not at all.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 4th. Femi Oke is here with the headlines. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. We have some new unemployment claims figures this morning. Claims dropped a little bit. They're now at 509,000. But continuing job claims are at their highest point since the early 80s. Among those who may be filing later this month for unemployment are some 12,000 AT&T workers. The company announced the cuts this morning. That's 4% of its workforce. In Europe, the Bank of England slashed official interest rates by 1%. The European Central Bank did too, by 0.75%. Condoleezza Rice is in Pakistan today, talking to military and civilian leaders. Secretary Rice says the Pakistani leadership has told her that it's committed to helping India investigate last week's militant attacks in the city of Mumbai. The president of Pakistan said his government would take strong action against any Pakistani elements found to be involved in the assault on Mumbai. Two suicide car bombings near police stations in Fallujah this morning have killed 15 people in Iraq and wounded more than 100 others. One police station was said to be leveled. It's believed the bombings were coordinated because they were just a few minutes apart. Iraq's government says it got a call from President-elect Barack Obama. The Prime Minister's office says that the President-elect thanked the government for helping win approval of a new security pact and stressed his commitment to responsible troop withdrawal. J.K. Rowling has a new book out, the first since she finished working on the Harry Potter series. Fans in the UK were the first to get their hands on Rowling's latest work, and as always, they were extremely enthusiastic.
Excitement, anticipation. I was always sick on the train up. I was just so excited.
Now, the book is called The Tales of Beedle the Bard. It's a series of fairy stories and no Harry Potter in it, but it is set in Harry Potter's magical world. The book goes on sale today.
I tell you, people would buy her laundry lists if she wrote them out by hand and sold them, I think.
Well, she probably would say them so nicely.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we're becoming a nation of part-timers. All week long, we're looking at the changing labor force. You know, you got a slash. Tell us about it.
I am a full-time mother, a full-time nanny of two babies. I also have a business where I'm making shirts and baby shirts for people, K Designs. And the slashes work for me, and they allow me to be with my son all the time.
Mom slash nanny slash shirt maker. Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Now we're going to talk about politics. President-elect Obama's new chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, is described as a hard-charging partisan, not only during his time in the Clinton White House, but also during his time as a Chicago congressman. In between, he took a turn as an investment banker, pulling in a reported $18 million. This morning, we're joined by Michael Luo, political reporter for The New York Times, whose front-page story in The Times today takes a look at what it means for Emanuel's new role in the Obama administration. Michael, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, the first question that comes to mind is conflict of interest. How do you think that plays out here?
Well, I mean, this is not the first time that someone has raised Rahm's Wall Street connections, but it is a little-known episode in his biography, and he did develop close ties with people in the industry. He has friends in the industry that he still calls on occasionally to check in with them about how things are going, how the markets are going, economic advice, and he has raised a lot of money in Congress from these people too. So there are going to be inevitably going to be questions as the Obama administration moves to consider new regulations and that kind of thing to avoid another economic meltdown. And there's going to and his Wall Street connections will be scrutinized.
Let's back up. In your story, you describe how in just 2.5 years he made $18 million. How'd that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's an unusual amount for a novice managing director like he was with no prior financial experience. But number one, he was a very successful and effective banker. And, you know, investment bankers, their money is mostly not made in salary, but in bonuses that dependent on the business that you bring in. And he brought in a lot of business. But he also got a little bit lucky. His firm, Wasserstein Perella, was sold while he was there. And that enabled him to benefit from an equity stake he had in the firm, but also the German bank that bought the firm paid out these large retention bonuses to key employees to keep them on. And so he got a large retention bonus based on his prior performance. So he got a little bit lucky. I mean, he left politics, I think, from talking to friends of his to get some economic security, get some financial security, so he might be able to go back into politics. And he did much better than he really could have realistically imagined at the time.
You know, that's really the bio here. He's a really lucky guy who's taken advantage of his opportunities, and there have been many. I guess, does this prepare him for a time of adversity when, you know, the dice isn't necessarily going to roll your way over the next 4 years?
Well, I mean, I guess the more relevant question for me and why I was interested in this period in his biography is does this period in his biography give him some special insight into the financial services sector, which is really at the heart of what's going on right now? And I guess I would say it doesn't hurt. I mean, when I did get a chance to speak to him briefly, and he spoke pretty knowledgeably. At least he used a lot of big words about banking, and I'm sure that helps.
He's a great dancer too. Right?
Yeah, that's what I understand.
That's an amazing. I mean, he could have gone to Juilliard at Sarah Lawrence.
Yeah, I mean, but this luck obviously is also he self-made that luck too, and I mean that one. The other interesting piece of this part of his biography is that, you know, he clearly used his political connections to help drum up business. Not necessarily. There was no evidence that I found that, like, you know, he was calling up like important people in the White House on behalf of clients, so that kind of thing, and that would be very difficult to discover, first of all, and I didn't find any evidence of that. But clearly, he had a big Rolodex. He was a chief fundraiser for Bill Clinton in his first presidential run, chief fundraiser for Mayor Daley in Chicago, so he knew a lot of people, and that's what you need in investment banking. And he did a good job of calling up a lot of these people that he knew from politics and saying, hey, I'm in banking now. Do you have any deals, or, you know, and being aggressive and pushing for that?
I mean, Michael, you're essentially describing the American way. I'm wondering what your thought is on how this business experience will affect his next job at Obama's side, specifically that there's been some who have criticized him, perhaps saying he might be more sympathetic towards business concerns because of that experience.
Yeah, and I think that is possible. I think his friends on Wall Street consider him to be not an ideologue, but someone who's pragmatic. And folks on the left have been upset by Emanuel for being one of these sort of third way Democrats, pushing Democrats to more of a centrist sort of policy. And we'll see how it goes. He points out that he has made some moves that have been opposed by the industry. He voted to eliminate that carried interest provision that on the way private equity firms, their profits were taxed. That would increase it dramatically. And there's a couple of other steps that he took, couple other measures in Congress that he took that were independent of the industry.
Taking great pains to say that he is an independent thinker, but that he's willing to listen to both sides.
That's what he's trying to say. But, you know, clearly he has their ear and, you know, he takes their calls and he knows who to talk to. We'll see how that plays out.
Michael Luo, thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Luo is a political reporter for The New York Times, reporting on Rahm Emanuel.
And as reporters and lawmakers get ready to take a look once again at the big three automakers, we are thinking about this nation becoming a nation of part-timers all week long. We're looking at the changing labor force. We want to hear if you're a registered nurse during the day, a dog walker at night. What are your slashes? How do you make a part-time career knit together as an income and get you through the hard times? Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, we're always on at The Takeaway, of course. You can follow our entire series on underemployment at our website. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
And here's your takeaway for today.
You're asking members of Congress to come in for one last week right before Christmas, and that in and of itself might hurt the chances for a bailout.
A bailout for the auto industry, at least that's what the CEOs are hoping today, as they make their bid on Capitol Hill. That's Micheline Maynard, Detroit-based business correspondent with The New York Times, with her thoughts.
We'll know a lot more about whether there is a chance for a bailout after today's hearings. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.